Good morning. Greetings in the name of Jesus to each of you. Thank you, Mervyn, for pulling that down. And as was mentioned, welcome to our visitors. Welcome to the home folks. Good to see everyone here. I'm kind of like a train on a track. I get started and I don't veer off too much, and I actually didn't even think about it at the beginning of the week that maybe this should be a Thanksgiving message, but me and Mervyn communicated a little bit, and he said he would be happy to preach a Thanksgiving message, so thank you, Mervyn, for doing that. I believe he's planning to preach next Sunday. So for you visitors, we've been working our way through Genesis. We began with chapter 1, and we're up to chapter 9 now. So this is going to be kind of a part one of two-part message, and if I was just paging through my Bible, thinking of a message that I want to preach, looking at different chapters, 9b and chapter 10 is one that I would never say, oh yes, let's preach about this. You know, it's just one of those that you tend just to skip over. And it's kind of weird. Uncovered Noah and genealogies is basically what it amounts to. But as I was working through the first 11 chapters of Genesis, for some reason, this is chapter 10 is supposed to be there. It is supposed to be there. Can we say that the God inspired chapter 10? Chapter 9b, that's inspired by God. I think we can say that. So should I ignore it? Should I skip over it? Should we keep on going? I don't want to ignore it. And I thought, well, we'll just go ahead and spend some time here. So I won't have a real punchline today like I like to at times, you know, have a conclusion, because this is just a part one. Conclusion will come at the latter, or yeah, in chapter 11. But I think you'll be able to see where we're going. I'll have a few concluding verses then. We noted that Genesis 3 through 11 notes the problem of humanity. It's kind of like one unit. All right, so we have about, 3 through 11. It's 8 or 9 chapters there of Adam and Eve's, beginning with Adam and Eve, taking of the fruit in the garden, and ending with Babel. All right, that roughly covers 2,000 years of history. That's 1/3 of human history. Abraham, the next numerous chapters, over 10, are just strictly of Abraham. So in time frame, we've slowed down to just a few years for the next however many chapters. And so you really stop and think about that. Why did they choose these stories? For example, Noah lived 350 years after the flood, and they chose this story about Noah and put it in here. Why would you choose that story? I'm sure there's lots of wonderful stories in 350 years of time they could have chose, but they chose the story that we're fixing to read. And it's just like, oh, why? Why not a nice story? But anyway, think of this as a unit. We're exploring the problem of humanity, the problems that the Bible lays out, and as I just read the story, and the more I meditate on it, I discover that I fit into that story, and I see myself fitting right in with this story, and whatever solution that's going to come through Abraham, I need that. So that's kind of where your mind should be going. Okay, so a little bit of review. You remember we just came through the flood in chapters 7, 8, and parts of 6, 7, and 8. And there was a comment that we've seen before the flood concerning something that God said in his heart. Two key phrases concerning God's heart. The one before the flood was that God looked over the wickedness of the earth, that it was great, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Okay? After the flood, God makes this new world again. Remember, we have the first year, the first month, the first day of the month. And like Genesis 1, God blesses Noah and his sons and tells them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the land. Exact same thing that God told Adam and Eve, that God told humanity in chapter 1. Well, after the flood, God says this. He says, he talks about the fact that he's not going to bring a flood anymore or smite every living thing. The Lord said in his heart, I will not again curse the ground anymore for man's sake. For the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. So when we talked about floods do not cure man's heart. And so we have a new world, but we have the old humanity. Does that make sense? We have a new world, but man's heart hasn't been changed. So what for stories do you think we're going to read about in this new world? Second time we have a new world. Now when I say new world, a new beginning, a fresh start. Peter calls it a new world, the world that then was and the world that now is. But anyway, what kind of stories do you think we're going to read about? One more review. We looked at the covenant that God made with Noah and his sons and with all flesh, all living flesh. Can someone remind us again? How many times was the word covenant used in that chapter, in verse 9 through 17 that we read last time? How many times was the word covenant used? It was 7. Okay? 7 times. In chapter 1, God said that his creation was good 7 times. How many times did God say, I? He used the phrase, I. For example, I establish my covenant. I will establish my covenant. This is the covenant which I will establish. I do set the bow in the cloud. I bring the bow over the cloud. How many times is the word I used in that framework of the covenant? 11? Almost. Almost. It's 10. Very good. 10 times. 10 times God spoke in chapter 1 in creation, in creating his world. 10 times it says, and God said. 10 times God says, I. So we looked at the existence of humanity is not for anything that they've done. It's simply the mercy of God upon humanity. How many ifs were in that covenant? There were 0 ifs. No ifs. It's an unconditional covenant. It's simply God saying, I extend my mercy to humanity. I want humanity. I want to partner with humanity in ruling this creation. And we're going to have to figure out another solution to the problem. All right. So another bit of review here. Remember that Adam had 3 sons. Seth, Abel, and Cain. 10 generations later, we get to Noah. Noah has 3 sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. 10 generations later, we get to Abraham. Abraham is 1 of 3 sons. Now, Abraham doesn't have 3 sons. He's 1 of 3 sons. Abraham, Nahor, and Haran are Abraham's brothers. So, if God created a new beginning for Noah and his sons, you're kind of set up. Adam and his sons had a new world. Noah and his sons are going to have a new world. When we get there, we'll discover that Abraham is also going to have a new beginning. He's going to be pulled out from his family, and God's going to walk with him to a new beginning. There's language of blessing. I will make thee a great nation. Same type of thing. So we have new beginnings here, but we have the same human. So what kind of stories do you think we're going to read this morning about Noah and his sons? Because man's heart hasn't changed. Do you think they will pattern something that we've already read? Do you think we're going to be able to see a pattern? Well, maybe. Keep that in mind. So let's begin. I already mentioned this, that 2,000 years of approximate history to Abraham, that's one-third of human history, by the way, that we're covering in just 11 short chapters. All right, let's begin by reading chapter 9. Let's begin right after the covenant that God made. It's verse 18 that we'll pick up. Verse 18. And the sons of Noah that went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Again, this is chapter 9 of Genesis, verse 18. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. By the way, Ham is the father of Canaan. These are the three sons of Noah, and of them was the whole earth overspread. Now, why would you insert that about Ham and Canaan? Isn't that kind of odd? We're talking about the sons of Noah, and then all at once we insert one of Noah's grandsons into the picture. By the way, Ham is the father of Canaan. Just notice that. Notice that it's added there. Okay. Chapters 10 and chapter 11 is all about what we just read there. It's the story of Noah and his sons going forth from the ark, being fruitful and multiplying. And there's a story about Ham and Canaan. And of the whole earth being overspread by them. So that's what we're going to be looking at the next two messages, today and the next one. Let me catch up with my notes here. Okay, let's begin with the story here. Verse 20. Here's the story of Noah, the one story that was chosen out of 350 years of history. Verse 20. And Noah began to be a husbandman, and he planted a vineyard or a garden, same Hebrew word. And he drank of the wine and was drunken. And he was uncovered within his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brethren without, outside the tent. Verse 23, and Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon their shoulders and went backward and covered the nakedness of their father, and their faces were backward, and they saw not their father's nakedness. And Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done unto him. All right, so Noah's drunk and unclothed. And then whatever Ham does, Noah wakes up from being drunk, and he is in a really bad mood. And he said, cursed be Canaan. Now, wait a minute. Who was in the tent? It was Ham. Okay, so we take it out on the grandchildren, huh? Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brother. And he said, blessed be the Lord God of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. And God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. And then the genealogy picks back up where it left off. Way back in chapter 5, remember we had a break in the genealogy through the flood all the way up to now, and Noah lived after the flood 350 years, and all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. And this is how Noah goes out in the Bible. What a puzzling, strange story. All right, I see that I messed up here on my slideshow. I guess I forgot to All right, we want to start at the top there. That's the verses that I read about Noah's three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And then it inserts there on the underlined part that Ham is the father of Canaan. And then we have the poem here. That this is a poem that Noah says. A little bit about the poem. You'll notice that Noah doesn't bless Shem. He blesses the God of Shem. So you get the idea that Shem will be blessed. All right, and then Japheth is to dwell in the tents of Shem. So I'm not sure. I think that's a slightly lower status. I'm not 100% sure on that. But you have Shem, the God of Shem's blessed. Japheth will dwell in the tent of Shem. It'll be a large dwelling in the tent of Shem. And then Canaan will be their servant. Three times in this little poem, Canaan is called a servant, and he's cursed as well. Okay, so how do we understand this? What just happened? Why is Noah cursing grandson instead of his actual son that went into his father's tent and saw him uncovered and went out and told his brothers about it? Why are we cursing Canaan? Why is Canaan mentioned in Noah's sons in verse 18? So I will offer you one possible solution using two just logical conclusions that I've made, or that I've gathered. I didn't come to this conclusion on my own. When we go and read genealogies, does it ever mention that the wives of the men? It says Noah begat three sons. We already read that this morning. Never mentions his wives. Now, did Noah actually begat a son? I mean, easy question, right? No, his wife. We would say that his wife begat son. He was the father. Throughout all the genealogies we have yet to mention, or basically yet, Eve. We have Eve mentioned and maybe one other. But the wives are typically not mentioned. It's a patriarchic system where you don't mention the women. It's just the men. That's what's going to be put in the history books is the men. So we notice there that the women have not been mentioned. In Leviticus, there's two scriptures that might enlighten us a little bit more. Leviticus 18:8, the nakedness of thy father's wife shalt thou not uncover. It is thy father's nakedness. Another similar verse, a few verses later in verse 16, thou shalt not uncover the nakedness of thy brother's wife. It is thy brother's nakedness. So a possible solution is that Ham committed incest. This was a sexual sin that he committed against his very own mother, which would explain why, at the very top of the screen, why Ham is mentioned with the sons of Noah, but yet it clarifies that it's not Noah's son. But it is, sort of, but it's not. Canaan is the fruit of that incest, of that sexual sin. So Ham is the father. It's of Noah's wife. That's a possible solution to the problem. And Noah curses Canaan so that Canaan does not get in on Noah's family, Noah's inheritance, his family lineage. It removes him from Noah's lineage to his son's lineage. So we have if you go with this explanation, it's the only one that I could make sense out of. If you go with this, it explains the severeness of the cursing. It explains a lot of what's going on here. And it also is a tragic family crime. Do we have a story earlier? We had a new world. We had do we have a couple that was in a garden, that ate of the garden, and it seemed like a very simple act of disobedience, just a very foolish thing, but nothing major, that led to a son committing a tragic family crime. It's the Cain and Abel story. So we have Noah, or Adam and Eve, and then we have Canaan murdering Abel. here we have Noah, and then we have his son, Ham, and the tragedy here. So, again, we have a new world without new humanity. This splendid opportunity that Noah and his sons had to go into the world and spread goodness and love and just fill it with the goodness of God apparently is not taking place, or if it is, we're not told about it. A failure by the parents leads to even a greater failure by the next generation, which leads to separation and curses. And you'll remember that Cain was eventually cursed, and he was pushed out. God drove him out of the region of Eden. Now we have another. We have Canaan cursed because of the act of his father, Ham. Here we go. We have divided families, bitter family relationships, and just a broken world in general that we're told about. All right. So if you remember, we had Adam and Eve, and then we have Cain murdering Abel, and we followed Cain's lineage down to Lamech. Y'all remember Lamech, the seventh generation from Cain? All right, he killed people because they offended him. He was bragging to his two wives in a little poem, saying how he murdered someone for offending him, for striking him. And then we followed Seth's lineage, and the seventh generation was Enoch. And you have like the two, you're all like, wow, what a comparison. Enoch walked with God and was not because God took him. All right, so we're going to similarly do this now. We're going to go in chapter 10, and we're going to see the lineage of these sons. And chapter 10 is often called the Table of Nations. There are 70 nations that spring forth out of chapter 10. You have the number 7, which is spelled with the same words in Hebrew as the word complete. It often means, symbolically means to either be complete or full. These 70 nations that are mentioned are not necessarily, in other words, it's not like there was just 70 nations, but these are the 70 nations that are going to play a big part in the Bible story. All right? And so I feel like it's 70. These 70 are to represent all the nations of the world, even though I'm pretty sure there's more than just these 70. But chapter 10, this is important to get. Chapter 10 travels far out into the history beyond chapter 11 of the Babel. So it goes way out. We're going to go many generations out beyond Babel. So Babel will take place in chapter 10. And then we're going to back up with chapter 11, and then we're going to learn how chapter 10 became to be. It'll give us some more insights. The narrator, the one that's writing this, is going to pause at a few times and insert some information. And I want to make sure that we catch that. Sometimes he'll just go through and just list off name after name after name, and then he'll pause and say, oh yeah, by the way, this one here, this happened when he was, or this is the beginning of his kingdom, or whatever. So I'm not going to read it all, partly because I don't think you would enjoy that, and I don't know how to pronounce all the names, but I'm going to go through, and we're just going to point out some interesting things about these three sons of Noah and their descendants. And it begins with Japheth. So let's read chapter 10, verse 1. Now these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And unto them were sons born after the flood. So it begins with Japheth. And the sons of Japheth, And then it speaks of Gomer. There's seven sons there. Magog mentions Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Triaz. Now, there's a total of 14 descendants of Japheth mentioned. Most of these descendants settled north of Israel in the northern hemisphere. So they occupied areas like Europe. Gomer likely occupied Germany, France, and Spain. It's kind of interesting. Most of our heritage comes back from Europe. I have no idea if there's a connection here. So it mentions seven sons of Japheth in verse 2, but then it only mentions two sons and their descendants in verse 3 and 4 for another total of seven grandsons. So it mentions the sons of Gomer and it mentions the sons of Javan, and none of the other seven sons of Japheth are even mentioned. So that's one reason I say this is probably not a totality of the nations or the people. But it's the one who are going to play significant themes in the Bible. Okay. Javan is the Hebrew name for Greek. Javan would have settled in Greece. Tubal settled in modern-day Turkey. How many of you see the name Tarshish? So verse 4, Javan has three sons. One of them's name is Tarshish. Anyone remember the name Tarshish? Okay. Tarshish settled in modern-day Italy. That's where Rome is. In 2 Chronicles 9:21, Solomon was in really good relationship with Tarshish. And Tarshish is known for its ships, its big ships. You'll often read poems in the Bible about ships. Anyway, for whatever it's worth, 2 Chronicles 9:21, for the king's ships went to Tarshish with the servants of Hiram. Every 3 years, once came the ships of Tarshish, bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and peacocks. So exotic animals, gold and silver. So Solomon had this league with Tarshish. So you're dividing brother lines. Saul is from the line of Shem, and Tarshish is from the line of Japheth. Two brothers. The descendants are actually working at this point. That's very unusual. Okay, then we get this little conclusion line at the end of Japheth's 14 descendants that says, by these were the Gentiles, were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, everyone after his tongue, after their families, in their nations, plural. So 14 nations. And notice the dividing. Okay, the Tower of Babel is way more than a halted construction project. All right? They were divided. Okay, so here's a map. And you can see here where Japheth settled. So right here is Israel in this little spot. And the red is all Japheth's descendants. And maps do vary. I discovered that very quickly. But anyway, this one here, I figured with the color reading, you could tell a little easier. So right here is the current day Iran, and right here is current day Turkey. And then over here is Tarshish. This is Italy. Rome is up here. And parts of Europe. Greece is somewhere in here. I don't remember. I think maybe right here. This is Asia Minor. This is, maybe Greece is right here. Anyway, that gives you the idea. Next, we're going to look at Ham's descendants. All right, Ham is here in the green. We have the Canaanites that inhabited the land that Israel was to gain for an inheritance. We have Egypt's going to be right here. And then we have Ethiopia's going to be all the way down here under Egypt. And let's see, I'm not sure. We'll cross some more bridges as we get there. But that kind of gives you an idea of where they settled. There's a total of 30 descendants of Ham mentioned, 30 nations out of Ham. So way more than, over double of what Japheth has. All right, and these descendants were mostly south of modern-day Israel. You'll notice that, from the descendants of Cush came the Ethiopians. All right, you remember the story in Acts about the Ethiopian eunuch? So that would have been a descendant of Shem and a descendant of Ham brought together by the gospel. So we have the Ethiopians way down in the south of Egypt. Mizraim is where the Egyptians came from. Of course, they would have settled in Egypt. And Put is where the Libyans came from. They settled west of Egypt in northern Africa. You'll notice in verse 7, so we have the beginning of the sons of Ham mentioned there in verse 6. It mentions that he had four sons. And then in verse 7, you have seven sons listed. Some of them that might be of note to you is the second to last son, Sheba. Okay? There's a story in Job that we have about the Sabians falling upon Job's servant and took them away, and the one servant that seen it all came and told Job about it. All right? These are his descendants. Okay? So it's the descendants of Ham fighting against the descendants of Shem. You'll also remember the story of the Queen of the South. Remember that? Queen of Sheba? The Queen of the South, Sheba, shall rise up in judgment with this generation and shall condemn it, for she came from the uttermost parts of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, a greater than Solomon is here. So as you read the New Testament, one thing you will pick up in is that the seed of the woman comes through Shem, but Japheth and Ham, descendants, are more open to the gospel than Shem's. It's completely flipped, the opposite of what you think. Multiple times you will hear Jesus commending the faith of the Canaanite woman or some other woman, some other person, and most of the time they're either descendants of Japheth or Ham. They are more open to the gospel than what the descendants of Shem, the seed of the woman that comes through. All right. Some more interesting things. This is where we have a narrative break in verse 8. So we have the seven sons of Cush in verse 7, and then we have one more son of Cush. And let's just read that. And Cush begat Nimrod in the earth. Sorry, and Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. That phrase, mighty one, is the word gibor. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. So this is eerily familiar. In Genesis 6:4, pre-flood, there were giants in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bare children unto them, and the same became mighty men. Gibor, there's that word again. These are the gibor, which were of old men of the name. Here we have another gibor with a great name. So this man has a household name. He was a mighty man. When your sons are out shooting their bow and one just makes an awesome shot from 100 yards, the comment would be made, wow, that was a shot like Nimrod would have made. He's a mighty man. He can do amazing things. So he's a household name. Well, guess what? Verse 10, the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Babel is a transliterated word. Babylon is the translated word. So it's going to be called Babel until after chapter 11, because it means to be confused. For some reason, the translators chose not to translate it, but transliterate it. So, The beginning of this man's kingdom is Babylon, the absolute arch rival of the children of God. From Genesis to Revelation, you have Babylon. This is the foundation of Babylon. So you are getting extremely negative tones out of the scriptures from the covenant that God made through the sons of Noah and now on down through the through their sons, through the grandsons, and so on. Well, you want to know what else came out of Babylon? Verse 11, out of that land went forth Asher. All right? The Assyrians. This is the father of the Assyrians. And he builded Nineveh. And then several other cities, Calah, Rehoboth, Resen. And then it goes on in verse 12 and says, Resen is between Nineveh and Calah. That same is the great city. Let me catch up with my screen here. So we have Nineveh mentioned as that great city. There's only one other time where Nineveh is mentioned as a great city. Can someone tell me where that is? Jonah, yes. So when you read the book of Jonah, apparently you're supposed to be thinking back here at this table of nations. Jonah is from the seed of the woman, from Shem. Okay? He's sent to the descendants of Ham, but he goes to Tarshish to the descendants of Japheth. I mean, he's just trying to get out of here. So he tries to go to Japheth. The descendants of Japheth appear to be in fairly good connection with God, or they know God's displeased with them, and so they cast lots to get this evil person off. It lands on the Shemite, Jonah. Jonah gets cast off, and then he goes to the Hamites, to Nineveh, and guess what? They repent. The loser in the story is Jonah, and Jonah's angry about it. Again, you'll notice that the Gentiles are more open to God's calling than what the Shemites are. It's just a pattern you'll see largely throughout the scriptures. All right, that was a side note. Okay, another notable one. This is all descendants of Ham. This is the one that went into his father's tent. Okay, he has the most descendants. We'll spend the most time with him. One more. One of his sons was named Mizraim. I think I'm pronouncing that right. And he begat Casluim, out of whom came the Philistines. Are the Philistines going to play a big story in the Bible? Absolutely. So these, at the end of the day, these are brothers fighting against brothers. Families fighting against families. And just stopping and thinking about that, just wow. All right, concluding statement from the lineage of Ham. These are the sons of Ham, after the nation, after their tongue, in their countries, and in their nations. So obviously, after Babel, when the languages were confused. All right, then one more picture of the map. This is the last one that I have. So you again, Ham, here's Egypt. And then, you know what? I forgot something. That is not the end of Shem. That is not the end of Ham. I keep getting these names mixed up. So Ham's son, Canaan, has 11 sons that settle right here in Canaan. All right? It lists them here in verse 15. It's in 16. The Jebusites, Amorites, Girgashites, Hivites, Arkites, Sinites, the Hamathites and the Canaanites in the land of Canaan. So these 11 sons are going to be the arch rivals of the 12 sons of Jacob, and they're going to be fighting over this land in the future. So Egypt is here, and Israel's going to come up out of Egypt and eventually end up over here where Jericho is to inherit the land. I find it interesting. So Lebanon. See there, Heth, right there says Ham, the Hamathites. I find it interesting that they're in the region of Lebanon. Right there's where Lebanon is. And even today, you have Hezbollah. I don't know if there's any connection, but the region sure is the same. The name sounds awfully familiar. Hezbollah and Israel are still fighting. And then you have Hamas down here in Gaza, and they're still fighting with the Jews. I don't know. It sounds strikingly familiar, but I have no proof of that. All right, we need to wrap this up. Just a few comments on the descendants of Shem. There's 26 in total. In verse 21, when Shem is introduced, you have this comment that Shem, unto Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber. Okay, this Eber is where we get the word Hebrew. This is the beginning of the Hebrew family, the Hebrew children. And apparently, the name is emphasized several times here, and it begins off with that. It seems like we're supposed to know something about that. A few interesting things in verse, one of his sons is Uz. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. So we know that Job is from the descendants of Shem. Okay, in verse 25, we have Eber, this Hebrew man. He had two sons, and the name of the one son was Earthquake, Peleg, and unto Eber were born two sons. The name of the one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. There's another break in the genealogies. And his brother's name was Joktan. And then it goes on to list them, and we get to the end there, and there's just some summary statements. The summary statement for the descendants of Ham: these are the sons of Shem. Sorry, I'm getting the two mixed up again. These are the sons of Shem, after their families, after their tongues, in their land, after their nations. And then the summary statement of the whole chapter, which is very similar to the beginning statement of the chapter: these are the families of the sons of Noah, after their generations, in their nations, and by these were the nations divided in the earth after the flood. So you'll notice that this word divided keeps coming up. This is going to be very important for next time. This word divided keeps coming up, and there's multiple tongues. Okay, just a few scriptures in conclusion here. So as a reader of the Bible, we would expect that whenever God comes to fix this problem that we've been reading about, that it's going to fix all of it, right? Not just some of it, but all of it. And just give you a sneak peek into next message. The church is part of the solution. Did you know that? So this is Paul in Ephesians. Although I'm the least of all the saints, this grace was given to me to bring to the Gentiles the news of the boundless riches of Christ, and to make everyone see what is the plan of the mystery hidden for ages in God, who created all things, so that through the church the wisdom of God in its rich variety might now be made known to the rulers and authorities in heavenly places. And we're going to talk about the rulers and authorities in the next chapter. But the church is the place where it doesn't matter if you're from Ham, Shem, or Japheth. It doesn't matter what your skin color is. It doesn't matter what your background is. You can be accepted into the family of God. And it is such an incredible thing, because this is nowhere else in history does this take place, that you can be accepted and loved and be counted as one. It's the church is the answer for that. And of course, that's only going to happen if God's Spirit is there in the church. Stephen made this comment, no, not Stephen, Paul, on Mars Hill, when he was preaching to the people there that were worshiping some unknown God. He said this, speaking of God: and he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and boundaries of their dwellings. So we have, as we leave chapter 10, 9 and 10, we're supposed to know that at this point the earth is divided There's nations are separated, and there's multiple tongues. It's a judgment, is what it is. And then when we get to chapter 11, we'll understand more details on that. But I just thought I'd leave you with that. The church is where this is supposed to be eliminated. Remember the words of Jesus. This is the NRSV as well. In Matthew 2, they came to him, the Pharisees did, and they're like, "Teachers, which one is the greatest commandment?" And of course, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the greatest and the first." "Oh, but the second one's just like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all of the Torah and the prophets." All of Genesis, all of the law and the prophets, the Torah and the prophets. This is what they're all about, you could say. This is what they're all pointing towards. This is what where they're all wanting to bring the conclusion to: loving God, loving your neighbor as yourself. So I just want to leave you with that. God bless you as you go see your families this weekend. Bless them. Know that families coming together in peace and love is unusual. It is just because of the love of God in our hearts that that's actually taking place. There's many families that will be broken families that will not meet around a Thanksgiving meal this Thanksgiving. If you have this opportunity, thank God for it. Bless your family, even those strange in-laws, like me. You probably won't change them, so just bless them, thank God for them, and enjoy each other and live in peace. It's a miracle. It really is. It is a miracle that we can come together in love with, yes, our spiritual family, but also our blood family. Let's kneel for prayer.